tsunami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 450 of the Toonami Escape podcast. I'm C. Kohler, and with me tonight is Seda.
Hello.
And Crocodile.
Good evening.
All right. Well, like I said, this is the second week of our new lineup that begins with Bleach. Before we go into the block, let's quickly talk about what little news there is. Really two items, but they're kind of related. The first is something we all sort of predicted would happen, which is we are definitely going directly into the third season of Bleach.
Now, is season three is a bit longer than the other seasons, or no?
No, it's about the same. It might be an episode longer. I'm not sure if it's 12, 13, or 14 episodes. I don't remember off the top of my head, but it's basically that length. So it might be an episode longer than normal, but...
I think it's maybe season one, 13, season two, 13, season three, 14, maybe.
Yeah, it might be that.
Even 40.
Speaking of which, I was a little confused. I didn't realize these Coors were 13 episodes. I thought this week was the final episode of the Coor we're on, or the part. But,
nope.
Yeah.
One more.
I guess there's one more.
That hasn't flip-flopped enough yet.
Yeah. And then really kind of related to that, since we got the updated schedule that indicated that we're going into season three of the Thousand Year Blood War, we also learned that the Thanksgiving weekend is going to be normal. There's not any kind of marathon or anything like that. And that's basically it. Not a lot of news this week. Just confirming that Bleach is here for the stay. I feel like Blue Exorcist is here for as long as they can run it. I had a thought. I'm curious what you guys think. When they kind of run out of Blue Exorcist eventually, or Bleach, whichever, I was thinking, you know, we've got, like, there's the final Coor of Dr. Stone that's going to be coming next year. I wonder if they'll do something like they did with Blue Exorcist, where they basically are going to be able to run all of Dr. Stone from beginning to the final end.
Yeah, maybe. Or, like, isn't My Hero Academia going to be similar, where we're, like, a season behind, but there's a final season coming out? I don't know the timing of that exactly, but...
I mean, the final season of MHA is happening right now, so probably over by the end of the year. But the thing is, Blue Exorcist was like 10 years old, so if they were justified in re-airing it, I don't see any reason for them to restart Dr. Stone from the very beginning if they get Dr. Stone.
You misunderstood. I didn't mean they'd start over. I just meant that they'd be able to start at the season we haven't gotten yet and just continue all the way to the end uninterrupted.
Oh, okay.
And you're right. I mean, the same thing with My Hero, technically. I mean, it's maybe plausible that they could, if they wanted to, bring My Hero back from the point where we stopped and then just continue to air it all the way to the series finale, you know?
I've lost count. There's one season of My Hero that we haven't seen, not including the final season.
Seasons 1 through 6. Then there's season 7, and then there's this final season, which is season 8.
Okay.
That's my understanding, I believe.
That's what I thought, too. But I might have, you know, I was wondering if I lost count or misplaced a season in there somewhere. But yeah.
Yeah.
There's also the final, this isn't quite the same, but there's also the last season of Demon Slayer that we never got. Unfortunately, that series is ending with movies, so we'll never see those.
Yeah, that's a strange one.
I mean, it could cut them up, but that'll be years down the line.
That'll be years after the movies finish. So,
what was the final season about?
Train arc.
Yeah, so we saw season 3, which I forget what it was called, the Sword Village, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think season 3 was split into two parts.
Yeah, season 4 is like the training arc, and then it's movies.
Oh, okay. I kind of forgot that existed.
My understanding is that the training arc was really stretched out from manga material, so I think the last episode of it was supposed to be really good, but they like took manga material, really stretched it out so they could just end at basically the final boss's door, but the final boss, like the final castle, takes like, I guess, half the series or something, or a third of the series, so that's what they're doing.
That's why they're making multiple movies out of it, right?
Yeah.
Gotcha. My whole point about bringing this up is that I feel like we're seeing a pattern here. It may not be nothing, but I'm seeing a pattern with Blue Exorcist and Bleach where it's like they wait until a point where they can get close to airing it nonstop. Because, you know, I wonder if that's more convenient for them to get a series that they can, they don't have to shuffle the block around if they just have all the episodes from now until the end of the series.
Yeah, maybe that consistency is worth it.
It doesn't apply to Bleach, though. Because there's season
four. No, and then that's not like, okay, maybe not all the way to the end, but they can keep it for a long time. You know what I'm saying? Like, they don't have to change the block as often.
Sure. I would imagine they restart from the beginning of the Thousand Year Blood War arc for Bleach in a later slot. And then whenever season four comes around, then they just, you know, change the block again to, you know, move Bleach back up or something.
Yeah. Did you have something else, Crocodile?
Oh, I guess the only thing I want to say was that if we're talking about series that could come to Toonami, Fire Force recently had its first season, and I think its final season is supposed to happen, I think, beginning of next year, I think. So that kind of fits into that pattern you're trying to draw of potential shows that they could run to the end or something if they wanted to wait till that before they came back.
Yeah, and let me, I guess I should just one more time, I'll reiterate. I don't necessarily mean that it's like from the now till the end. It's more like a show that they can keep for a long time. Like something that's relatively new that they can keep airing for a while. I mean, with Dr. Stone, it could work out that they could actually air the rest of the series. With Blue Exorcist, they can do that. But yeah, that would be another one where potentially they could do that. But it's more about, I think...
You mean like stockpiling seasons? So rather than airing them right away, just kind of get a few seasons release and then air them back to back.
Yeah, and that way you can kind of have a stable block that where, okay, they're going to have Dr. Stone on the block for, you know, 4 months or something like that. You know what I mean? Okay, just throwing that out there. All right, and that's all we've got for the news this week. So let's go ahead and jump into the block, and we will begin with Bleach. Bleach the Thousand Year Blood War, Core 2, Episode 12, The Master. So I wrote down names this time, and I am going to probably have to ask a little bit. The show starts out with Hiyori, who I have definitely seen this character before. She's like a short, young-looking girl with kind of like blonde ponytails.
Yeah, she played a big role in the Wakamon arc, or at least the parts of the Wakamon arc, but I don't know how much of that you saw.
Is she what they call a Visor?
Correct.
Visor.
Okay, that's what I thought, because she was with some other ones as well, I think.
Yeah, their whole group.
Yeah, so she kind of brought the Visors, but she was the only one who talked, and she was talking with Kisuke. Apparently, they had a plan, because she was in on the plan, and she's a little upset that Kisuke has kind of bucked the plan.
Yeah, they were supposed to go to the palace also, apparently.
Right. And she's a little miffed about that, like, why didn't you wait? And it kind of feels like Kisuke's got a plan of his own, so not really sure what's going on there.
Well, also, in this scene... Go for it.
Oh, I mean, I think it was partially because they didn't necessarily expect Yubao to use Ichigo's kind of reentry to himself shoot up to the royal palace. I think they eventually expect him to get there at some point, but maybe he got there sooner than they expected. So they kind of threw Ichigo at him. So that was my understanding that Yubao kind of got there earlier than expected. So that kind of threw things off on their end.
But also in this scene, we're introduced to Yoruichi's brother, whose name is Yushiro. I was thinking to myself, I do not remember Yoruichi having a brother. Is this the first episode he's in? And the answer is, according to the Bleach Wiki, yes. I don't know if he was mentioned before, but this is his first episode. According to the Bleach Wiki, this is the first time he's shown.
Yeah, so. I was going to say, I'm pretty sure he was mentioned before, but never seen before.
Yeah.
Yeah, they gave him a character introduction card when he appeared on the screen.
Yeah, I saw that.
And I didn't know one way or the other, but the way he was introduced, I got the impression this might be the first time we were seeing this character. Yeah. Just even as someone who doesn't know.
Right. That's what I thought. I was doubting my own memory. Like, I do not remember this person. Is it because I just forgot them or because they're never shown before? But no, I didn't forget him. He was never shown before.
Yeah, it's just kind of a like little like comedy bit in here, right, where he's like, I brought all these supplies and she's already left. And this just furthers my feeling about what this Thousand Year Blood War is about. I keep saying this, but like, this is the everyone is here part of the show. Like, everyone has to show up, right? Even characters we were only mentioned and never seen, they have to show up, right? So yep. I think this is another one of those, like, hey, here's that guy. Meanwhile, up in Super Heaven, Ichibe is battling off with Yuhabaha. They're kind of getting up in each other's face and getting ready to battle. Ichibe's got he's got like a giant paintbrush, which is part of his deal, which we'll see a little bit more of in the moment. And Yuhabaha's got his impressive moves. And we then cut back real quick to the other battle between the Royal Guards and the other Royal Guards. And it looks like D, the Death Dealing, who we thought he died, but he didn't.
It's Bleach, you know, so.
Yeah, right.
Just if it helps, the names are if you just scroll up a little bit, the names are still posted from last week.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So he's Askin, so if that helps at all.
Askin, yeah. So he is, he's like, oh, you thought I was dead, but see, I've done something to you. And he has the power. It's kind of confusing, and he even goes into great lengths about the fact that my power is really confusing. Basically, the short of it is that he turns Oyetsu's blood into poison. So a certain amount of the blood inside Oyetsu's body is now poisonous to him, and he starts to die.
It's technically like not like I could be more precise in that's not totally correct, but it's correct enough because I don't want to spend 5 minutes explaining the power, but that's correct enough.
Yeah. The point is, Oyetsu has too much poison blood in him, and he's starting to fall over. Meanwhile, Jungram is fighting Tanjiro. Now, Jungram is the guy that we talked about who kind of looks like... Jungram is the water guy, right? No.
He's the blonde.
He's the blonde.
He's like the right-hand man of Yuhabaha, the blonde one.
Right. He's the one who looks kind of like Aizen. And... He is fighting.
No, well, I guess
Askin looks like Aizen.
He's like the guy who broke Ichigo's sword episodes back. He's like blonde. He's almost like it's not like a mullet, but it's like longer shoulder length hair.
Okay. That's right. God, I'm getting these guys messed up. And then, so he's fighting Tenjiro, who is the hot spring guy. Okay. And so they're having a battle. I don't even remember what happens in their battle.
I think at this point, Hot Spring Guy kills him.
No, I think he was like, Jungro was like, had his shield up, and then like, he had a Hot Spring Guy had to do some moves to get the shield off him, to flip, like, you know, get his shield out, and then he did his like finishing blow, and Drummond fell over.
Okay.
So there was some cool, like, you know, staffs twirling and dipping and flipping and all that good jazz with, you know, little. But yeah, that's basically what happened.
Yeah. We cut right back to the Oyetsu and the other guy's battle. And we think that Oyetsu is on death's door when suddenly he's feeling much better. And it turns out that I wrote down Tanjiro, but it's not right. Tenjiro is there. And we're reminded, because this was brought up earlier in this arc, that his hot spring water can actually replace your blood. It can replace your blood with healthy blood. And so this, of course, undoes what was done to him, and now he's back at full strength again.
Yeah, this whole section felt very Bleach. I mean, appropriately, where there's a whole section here where he's like, how much do you weigh? Well, so many kilograms. Well, actually, this many kilograms. Well, did you know that per kilogram you have this many milliliters of blood? And... like, you know, yes. So on and so forth. It's like, well, even if you cut your neck open to like leak out some of your blood, you're going to die either way. And he's like, God damn it. And then he's like, well, not if I have this pool that can replace blood. You know, this whole section felt very Bleach.
Yeah. Meanwhile, while these three are going to at each other, Uryu is battling the woman Senjumaru. Not a lot happens in that battle that I remember.
I mean, Uryu just shoots some arrows and Senjumaru like deflects some of her umbrella that she weaves on the spot. And then they throw some wordy barbs like, ha ha, no, ha ha ha. And then, you know, so on and so forth.
We haven't really seen Uryu do much yet. And I'm just curious because I just like, it's still a question about where his allegiance lies here, even though it seems like he's 100% right now on the side of the Quincy's. I still don't buy that. So we'll see. We then cut back to the Ichibei and Yuhabahabite, and it is now revealed what the power that Ichibei has with his giant paintbrush, which, give me a moment on this one, because this is crazy. He swipes at Yuhabaha with the brush, but it doesn't cut him. Yuhabaha, for a moment, is kind of surprised. He's like, oh, you didn't do any damage to me. And then it's revealed by Ichibei that what you see is that my brush doesn't cut things physically. It cuts the names of things. And what he means is that he cut Yuhabaha's arms. So now he no longer has arms. He has R. Because it cut off the M and the S. Which ultimately just means his arms are like half as strong. Right?
Makes sense to me.
For a moment, I thought this was going to be really interesting, like deleting the half of something by its deleting half its name would like do something weird, but it just like diminishes its strength by half.
Well, there, I mean, that's just the tip of the brush of his power. So,
oh, okay. Well, let's see how this goes. If anyone has seen Chainsaw Man, I there was like the hint of something here. That is reminds me of stuff that happens in Chainsaw Man. It's like really bizarre, but it doesn't go there yet here. Maybe it will, but it hasn't gotten there. So.
You might have said this, but he also cuts Yuhabaha and says, like, now your name is just Yuha.
Yes.
And it's like, okay.
Okay. So that's the commercial break. When we come back, we cut back down to the Soul Society and we see Gigi is now all over Bambi and she's like ravaging her and she's like trying to suck her blood because basically Gigi had given Bambi her blood and now she needs it back. She goes, give me back your blood. And she's like really violently like assaulting Bambi. But then as she does it, she starts to like, oh, Bambi, I love you so much. And all this, she's just like all over the place.
It's very, very creepy and almost, yeah.
It's suggestive, yeah.
Yes.
Like, I want to say homoerotic, but definitely erotic of some sort, like necroerotic.
Necroerotic, yes.
Yeah, it is still strange to me that Bambi ended up being, like, the lesser of all these Bambis. But, yeah. So, anyway, that's happening, and then how do you say her name? Litoto?
Litoto? I don't know.
Litoto. She walks up, and she's like, oh, there you are, Gigi. And then they kind of have a brief conversation. They kind of bring each other up to speed, like, where's What's-Her-Face? And it's like, oh, well, this happened and that happened.
Yeah, it's actually fairly amusing because she's like, oh, Cupid or whatever his name is did this to me. And then I ate him. He tasted like shit.
Yes. I like that. So they're kind of caught up on what's going on. It was just like a kind of exposition moment for them. All right. Then we cut back to Super Heaven one more time at the palace, and Yuhabaha now breaks out his, well, maybe not his, I shouldn't say it like that, I should say brings out a new move. It may not be his ultimate move, probably not, but he brings out an amazing new move where he suddenly like creates this huge ball of light that shoots down into the Sarite. And suddenly, a lot of the lesser Stern Raiders start having their soul energy sucked out of them. Some to the point of they just, like, die. And others that just become super weakened.
There's some chatter in this section where they even, like, kind of expose it to us that they're not just stealing their, like, Reishi, but actually their life force. So.
Correct.
It's not just, like, depowering them. It's, like, actually killing them.
Well, yeah, if they get hit by it. Depends. Because this, I believe it's called the Auschwalen, and this is not the first time this happened, actually, because we saw a flashback of this. Remember how Ichigo's mother lost her powers and thus died to Grand Fisher?
Yeah.
and also how Uri's mother died, it's because Yubara used Ausvalen back then as well. So that's not the first time he's used it in canon or even in this arc.
Gotcha.
But it's basically he's the father of Quincy, so he can redistribute Quincy's powers as he pleases. That's basically the explanation here. And like what it does to Quincy kind of depends on obviously who the Quincy is and like how they're affected by attacks. So some of them it kills, some of them it weakens, and some of them it does other stuff. You'll obviously see the fallout in the following episodes.
During this section, sorry to interrupt, like Lil Toto actually like grabs Gigi and like tries to like avoid it by like going further in that little like crevice they're in, like try to like actually just avoid getting hit, which they're maybe like partially successful at this. If they can avoid getting hit, then maybe they're fine. And then there's a section where like Lil Toto loses her wings, so like she got like maybe partially hit. I'm not sure the full mechanics of this.
Yeah, I mean, you'll see the fallout in upcoming episodes, but I don't think it's too much a spoiler to say that some Quincy's die, some do not.
Yeah, and we do know already from exposition that, like, Yuhavaha is the origin of Quincy's, and then a lot of them owe their life to him or their existence to him to a certain extent. I'm not sure how that works, but we'll find out. But regardless, his ability to take their life force doesn't surprise me at all. I think what was the most interesting aspect of this scene, though, was how upset the Stern Ritters get at him during this. Like, there's a lot of them who are like, you're willing to do this to us, Yuhavaha, we followed you and you're willing to take our life force. Like, they're upset, reasonably so, but it's kind of like, well, this is just par for the course for Yuhavaha, because he treats his underlings like they're just fuel to him to a certain extent.
I mean, this is when we first were introduced to him, basically in the first few episodes, it was very clear he was the type of villain who relishes in killing his own minions. And I feel even old man Yamabuchi, did I say his name correctly?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yamamoto? Even he called out Yubara for being like, you don't give a crap about your underlings. And like, he doesn't. He constantly treats them like shit or disposable. So this is not surprising at all, because we see him so many times treat his underlings as incredibly disposable.
Yeah. And it should be mentioned here in the last bit for this episode is that he didn't just take their energy for himself. He gave it to his royal guards that are up there at the Soul King's castle. So I think that was part of the plan, was to re-energize or revive those members of his royal guard that had fallen or gotten hurt, and gave them life so they can fight some more.
What is that Final Fantasy spell that lets you revive someone but also boost their stats as well? I think it's a lot of RPGs, but I'm trying to think of the Final Fantasy equivalent.
Oh, I don't remember.
Like, it's basically that. It's re-raise plus haste plus guard plus reflect plus attack up, defense up, and all that good jazz and whatever.
Then we get the credits, and then the post-credits scene for this episode is that Kisuke is there, and then suddenly up walks Jushiro, and they have a brief chat. Now, okay, who is Jushiro?
Kisuke and Jushiro?
That's what it said.
Wait, I thought the ending was between the new head captain and the captain 13th squad, wasn't that? Or am I thinking of a different episode? Did I just totally mess it up, my man?
Well, I wrote down Jushiro because that's what the subtitle said. And then I looked up the guy's picture, and I think this was him. He was like a white-haired guy. Is that him?
Yeah, but he wasn't talking to Kisuke, because Kisuke Urahara wasn't in the... Was it... I'm forgetting the guy with the hat.
That's him, right?
No, Kisuke has has a hat, but the other guy who's now the captain of the court guard squad...
Oh, you mean Shunsui?
There we go. Thank you. It was Shunsui, and yes, Shunsui was there, not Kisuke.
Oh, okay, I got that wrong. Okay, Shunsui. Okay, so, but who is this Jushiro?
Oh, yeah, we know him. He's the captain of the 13th squad. He used to be Rukia's captain. He was in the Soul Society arc. He's been in previous arcs. So he's someone we're all familiar with. If you've been watching Bleach this whole time, you know who he is.
But did they say of anything of consequence, or are they just like, oh, I'm here and catch me up or whatever?
They are hinting to future events as best as I can tell.
Why is he no longer a captain? I forget.
I think it's Bonitis or something. I'm trying to remember. Remember, he is like, they actually explain it more in details later, but he basically has Bonitis, so. or anime dying disease, whatever you want to call it, but even though he's not a living creature, but whatever.
Maybe my memory's playing tricks on me. It must be my memory's playing tricks on me. I swore it wasn't Shunsui that was talking to him, but maybe I glanced over and saw Shunsui's hat and thought it was Kisuke's hat.
Shunsui does have a hat, and so maybe we just saw he shortcutted to Hat Guy, I guess.
Maybe, yeah. Okay. All right. Anyway, that was just like the quick post-credits scene for this episode. Okay, and that's it. A lot of fighting in this episode. I will say the fights were a little less interesting this time because I didn't find D that interesting, and I'm really confused by Ichibei's attack. I mean, it sounds like it has promise, but I don't really know what's going on there. I did like to see Litoto show up again. I like Gigi. I like seeing them, especially when they got angry about Yuhabaha taking their life force. I thought that was really cool. But other than that, yeah, it's just more fighting up in the Soul Palace mostly. It was okay. Oh, well, I guess I could just ask you that. Seda, do you have any, like, how did you feel about this episode? Good, bad, okay?
Very Bleach.
Very Bleach. That's a good point.
It was a very Bleach episode. Like, pretty much the whole episode was, like, I'll do this, no, I'll do this, actually this, no, haha, this. Like we basically saw each, we saw, like, Jugrum go down, and we saw a couple of the other, like, Royal Guards go down either in this episode or in the last episode, and then all of a sudden, surprise, they're back. Because they got revived. You know, like, yep, that's Bleach.
Crocodile, what do you think was the most important takeaway for this episode? Is it like that they're hinting at or they're showing something important that's going to show up later?
I guess there are a lot of little things here they kind of showed off that will be either explained or like hint. I guess it would say, I agree with Seda that it's basically a bleach-ass episode. Bleach-ass Bleach, basically. So I think it's just like little hints or teases of future events or whatnot. Or kind of like, I don't really know much else to say besides that. It's like Bleach-ass Bleach and then a lot of little teases for upcoming events.
Okay. All right, well, that is Bleach. So let's go ahead and move on then to Blue Exorcist. Exorcist, Beyond the Snow Saga, Episode 2, Distress. And the distress clearly in this episode is all about Yukio, who unfortunately continues to turn out to be more and more of a train wreck of a character here.
I can just hear Linkin Park in the background.
Yes. I'll insert a clip here. It's like, I get it, what they're going for here. I get what the author's going for. I'm not against this. It's just that, like, he's falling so far to a point where it's starting to become kind of a little ridiculous.
Like a parody
bit? It's almost a little bit comical, which I don't think it's meant to be.
Right. Like, yeah. Okay. Well, let's get through the rundown here. So Lightning and Shura are walking through the school, and they're having a quick chat, and they're talking about immortal demons. So this is something we talked about last week. We were like, what's the deal with the fox? Like, what were they doing there? What's the deal with the phoenix guy and Toto? And I think we were right. I think seems to be insinuating that these experiments they're doing are in order to try to learn more about how immortal demons work so that they can channel them and possibly make a body for the devil. And I guess Shura, Lightning is kind of questioning Shura. It's like, oh, don't you have an immortal demon? And she's like, no, the demon I have a relationship with isn't that powerful or something.
Yeah,
like that.
They specifically mention it's a Naga, which is like a snake. And she's like, well, the Naga that I know aren't immortal.
Right.
So,
but I guess what they're getting at here is that these experiments that we've been seeing, like with the last arc, it's something to do with trying to get immortality so that they can create an immortal body, I guess, for Satan. We learn that Yukio's eyes, his crazy eye powers, he mentions that it is not hereditary. I thought this was important to point out. Apparently, when he got his like checkup, remember, like a season or two ago, he got his checkup and learned that there's nothing special about him. He's got the blue eye powers, but he specifically said in this episode that it wasn't something that he got hereditary-wise. It was something that somehow he got some other way.
I guess that means there's something about Rin's eyes that can be, you know, observed through just modern medicine tech. Like there's something that you can just see in Rin's eyes and whatever technology they have that just says, yep, you have demon eyes or whatever, but that's not the case for Yukio.
Yeah, I do wonder, like, I remember him saying that. I do wonder if it's like, if he's actually correct or if it's more like they just couldn't tell, like, whatever nurses he was working with. Obviously, these nurses would be more familiar with demon physiology than the average nurse, but maybe they just didn't have the means to tell. Because obviously the question is, where did he get this if it's not hereditary? Because it feels like it would easily be explained by that. But I guess we'll see. Yeah. I'm just curious if he's correct or if he just thinks that and it turns out he's wrong.
I have a theory. I'm going to throw it out now early so I can either be right or wrong later. Here's my theory. I think he is correct. I think he knows it's not hereditary. I don't think the show is giving this as a red herring. I think he literally knows that. And when you think back to the scene where... What's the head of the Illuminati? What's he called?
Lucifer.
Lucifer. Thank you. When Lucifer was like really interested in seeing Yukio's eyes and he was giving him that bargain where he's like, if you ever want your power unleashed, come see me. I feel like what's happening here is that Yukio has been given this power by the Illuminati. And it's they're going to try to use Yukio against Rin, I think is what's happening.
Wasn't the first flare up against Toto? How would have Illuminati given him this power?
I don't know. That's my theory. And maybe that's when it happened. I mean, Toto was there, so.
I'm going to disagree with that slightly. I think it is something that manifests naturally, and that maybe the Illuminati are going to try to use it to their advantage. Oh. But I don't think they explicitly give it to him.
Okay. I think both those theories are pretty good.
Now, why did it manifest naturally? Who knows, but...
Well, Yukio's theory is that it only happens when he's super duper life-threateningly mortal fear scared. So he does some pretty stupid stuff. The first thing he does is he summons a bunch of water nymphs and then they create like a water bubble and he tries to drown himself. But of course, that doesn't work because he can't commit to it.
Also, during this scene, it does show a sneaky cut where it shows someone watching him.
Yes.
So...
Yeah, we couldn't make it out. They looked like they had a uniform on, but you couldn't make out what it was.
I actually tried pausing it to see if I could recognize it, and I couldn't. I'm sure...
Turn the brightness all the way up.
Yeah. Like, I didn't... I was wondering if it was, like, Renzo or somebody, but no, and Renzo's in the very next scene. So it's like, no, probably not him.
See, this is why I think it might have something to do with the Illuminati, because I wonder if that's somebody spying for the Illuminati. But who knows? I don't know. It could... For all we know, it could be...
It could have been Lucifer himself. Who knows?
Yes, or it could be the good guys sending someone to spy on him. I mean, yeah. Okay. My notes here, there was a lot that happened in this episode. My notes are kind of very cryptic.
Oh, so Rin and like the other friends, they're like studying for like the exorcist exams, or maybe not that exam. They're like studying in general, and they're talking about like knowing history in like a certain location. Like, Bone's not there. Bond's not there. And they kind of mention how like Bond's really good at studying and memorization and learning stuff and whatnot. So they're studying that. Bond shows up. He's like redone his hair. He's changing his look. And then there's kind of a weird scene here where he mentions he has a man crush on Lightning.
Oh, yeah, and yeah. Everyone thinks he means it in, like, the most literal way possible, when he just, no, I just really appreciate the guy. I don't want to, you know.
And they spend, like, a minute or two explaining that Konokomaru is making a phone app that's going to, like, help them.
Yeah, he's making a Pokedex, yeah.
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 Demon
Dex. That seemed kind of out of left field, but I guess, I don't know. But, yeah, that happens right before Shima walks up. And yeah, I'll tell you, when Shima arrived, I didn't recognize him. I didn't, I'm so used to that. Yeah, that's the same guy, right?
No, Suguro.
Suguro, not the same guy.
Sorry.
Renzo Shima is the pink-haired guy. And they
the pink-haired guy.
If you just watch this episode standalone, they don't even, like, Renzo's just there. Like, the fact that he's, like, this weird, like, double-double agent doesn't really matter right now. He's like, okay, yeah, he's studying too.
Right, I guess, although I wrote down that he wants to study because I thought that was important because it's kind of, again, he makes a point about the fact that he literally says, he's like, I wasn't planning on studying because I didn't think you guys were going to let me back.
Yeah.
And so I guess he's kind of committed now to still trying to be an exorcist, even though he never intended to.
But he does also say, remember, like, he fails, he found his calling. I think, wasn't that, you mentioned that in this episode? Like, he doubles down on the, I love being a double agent kind of thing, even like.
I think he says, if it's been, I don't remember exactly, but I think he says he hasn't chosen, like, which, because they have to, like, choose which type of test they're going to take, and he hasn't chosen that yet. I know, like, Rin later in the episode says he's going to take the night test, of course, and there's, like, an ARIA test. I think that's actually it. Renzo says he's not going to take the ARIA test. And these are, like, different, like, exorcist types, I guess. So that, I guess, maybe somewhat important in what type of test they take.
Yeah, I think Rin says, obviously, I'm going to be this because I use a sword and so forth.
Yeah, like that's later in the episode. And like Rin asks Shiami, I'm jumping ahead here, like what test she's going to take, and she hasn't decided yet.
Right.
Yeah, she's kind of been shaken because of events I feel Seiko is about to mention.
Yeah. So before we cut to the commercial break, we have to get one more check in with Dread Yukio here, who has decided that the only way he can summon his eye powers is to jump off the roof of a building to kill himself, which he does. And that's when we cut to commercial before he lands. We'll come back to this at the end of the episode. So when we come back from the commercial break, Rin and Shiami have, who are now, like, you know, other budding exorcists, they've been tasked with exorcising this really old house and told, don't destroy the house, but exorcise all the demons inside. And so they go inside. They give them a bunch of equipment too, which I think is, I don't know why this makes me chuckle, but it's like this idea that, like, they don't use, like, they don't solely use supernatural powers. They have, like, gear. So they're almost like the Ghostbusters to a certain extent.
And there's actually a kind of, there's kind of a weird, it almost feels a little bit contrived. There's kind of a weird thing they have to mention where Shiami is like, well, I'm going to put my stuff here for now, including my little, like, pet, whatever his name is, the little seed. Like, yeah, like, I'm going to put him aside here for now so he's not with me. And that becomes important that he's not with her.
Yeah, later. That's a setup so that they can be stranded. Yeah.
Right. So, like, it almost feels contrived to me, but sure, why not? You had to set him aside.
I guess she thought, oh, well, we won't need you. And then it ends up going to sleep in her, like, suitcase or whatever. Anyway, as they're trying to dispel all these little tiny demons, the floor breaks and they both fall down into the cellar underneath the house. And I think Rin gets his leg impaled on something, so he can't move. Shiami is also kind of, for a moment, sort of trapped underneath, like, a beam or whatever. And it's very cold and they end up just sort of sitting down there and talking. And this is the meat of the episode for the rest of the episode. It's all about Rin and Shiami. Rin is thinking to himself that she doesn't like him, that she really likes Yukio. That's what he keeps saying. And he's trying to be, like, nice to her, but not be flirty because he doesn't believe that she's into him.
Yeah, I actually do kind of appreciate that Rin kind of, for at least a moment, kind of realizes, well, Shiami, I like Shiami, but she's not really into me. So I'm just going to, you know, leave it at that for now and just treat her as a friend. Like, that's it for a moment. But then, you know, basically, this scene is very kind of like PG romance, right, at this point where it gets cold, Rin pulls out his flame, and basically Shammy's like, I really like your flame. And then he's like, I really like you. And then, of course, it gets really, you know, teenage awkward here.
Yeah, it's a nice scene because it finally addresses something. I mean, they don't completely resolve it, but he basically is like, do you like me or not? And then it forces Shiami to actually confront this issue that's been really bothering Rin. Unfortunately, her answer is that she's basically says, well, I'm too young for romance. And it's like, what?
Later in the episode, she even says, like, I'm so embarrassed I can't look at Rin. Which is, you know, not, that seems like not too uncommon for someone who's kind of working through their feelings, right? Like,
I guess
for a 15-year-old or how she's like
15, yeah, right, like it's like teenage confusion. Like she's probably thinking to herself, do I like Rin? I don't know, I haven't thought about it. So
she still comes off a bit emotionally stunted for me to a certain extent, because I feel like she should be more mature than this, but maybe she has lived sheltered in a certain way. So
right, that was something that was kind of stressed about earlier in the episode, which I think is something we didn't touch upon, which I thought you were going to, but her conversation with her mother about like Jamie was talking about what tests she wanted to take, and her mother was like, oh, you're actually going to do the Exorcist thing? That's kind of dangerous. Are you sure about that? And so like obviously her mother appreciates that Jamie is getting out more, which is a big contrast with her prior self, which is a part of why she's kind of sheltered and maybe not as well equipped to navigate some of these feelings she's having right now. But I think it also plays into how she was feeling a little unsure and doubtful about herself in the context of her conversation with Rin. So like she's obviously appreciated that conversation, and then they were kind of trying to awkwardly work through what each felt about the other and whatnot. That was definitely in the back of her head about like, what is her goal? What does she want to do moving forward? Does she want to go all in on the Exorcist thing? And I think that's also was kind of weighing on her mind as well.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, Rin kind of, his fire gets out of control and he ends up burning the house down as they're able to escape.
Well, I wouldn't say out of control. It's more like he flared up because they were like crawling with the demon bugs, whatever they're called. So he like intentionally flared it up to kill them all, but maybe it did a little more than he needed to, but I wouldn't necessarily say he went out of control.
They started noticing like those little like demons like floating in, and it kind of felt like, well, I know they told us not to destroy this place, but I have no other choice anymore, so I'm going to.
Yeah, and then he just walks up to that guy that was giving them the order. He's like, "Yep, sorry, I couldn't help it. And, you know, you told me not to destroy the house, but hey, what could I do?" You know. And then we get this sort of that scene about that you mentioned, where they're kind of walking away, and Yukio and Chiemi are rather awkward with each other. Chiemi can't really look
at
him.
Rin
and Chiemi are very awkward to each other, and Chiemi's now feeling strange feelings. And
yeah, we're now in that awkward puppy love like part of the relationship here, I guess.
Yeah, I'm a little concerned how long this is going to last, but we'll see. I guess it may be for the rest of the series, for all I know.
Concerned how long what will last?
We're in the awkward moment of the relationship.
Yeah, is Chiemi ever going to be able to like talk to Rin again? You know, that kind of thing. Okay. When we leave the sort of semi-comedy moment, we cut back to a shot of Yukio laying on the ground with a huge crater around him. He wakes up and he doesn't know what happened, but he realizes that his power must have worked because it somehow saved him. There's this huge crater and he doesn't remember it. You know, obviously it wasn't there before and something saved him. He feels confident in that moment that he must have somehow triggered his eye power to come out. But he's frustrated that he can't figure out exactly how to make it work. And so he comes up with another brilliant plan. All right. I'm pausing for a dramatic effect. He pulls out his gun and decides to just stick it to his freaking head, Persona style.
Oh, yeah. Evoker, right? That's what they're called.
Yeah. He's going to Evoker his persona. He's going to burn his dread, I guess. But then, what happens? Does he pull the trigger, or does it like not go off?
No,
or?
he gets a very well timed phone call from
Fisto.
And then that stops him.
Yeah, he gets a phone call. That's right. Yeah, he's gonna be putting on black eyeliner makeup real soon, I think. Okay, we cut back to the school. We learn, or maybe it was over the phone. I forget. We learn that, it's back at the school. Shura and Rin are summoned to Mephisto's office.
Yukio and Rin.
Gosh, I'm getting these names wrong. Shura. Thank you. Yukio and Rin are summoned to Mephisto's office, and Mephisto tells Yukio and Rin that Shura has gone missing. And they're like, uh-oh. And he's like, okay, I'm going to send you two to go find him. And this is where the arc's going to kick off, because apparently Shura has gone somewhere that's snowy. So here comes the snow.
And if you watch the opening of this season, like it seems like Shura is, you know, kind of a focal point.
Yeah.
And my only guess is that her conversation with Lightning must have like reminded her of something. Like, what is it with this Naga demon that I'm like familiar with? Like, what is that about? I'm guessing she's looking to find answers.
Yeah, because we see in the next episode preview that like Shura
meets up with
the snake demon who has like 1,200 eyes, and like the snake demon's like, remember your promise, Shura, and Shura's like, I have no fucking clue what you're talking about. So it's clearly something that in that vein and whatnot.
Well, you got it right on the head, Seda, because you're right. Having not seen the preview, that's exactly what's happening.
Oh, I thought you had seen it. I'm sorry.
But no, I didn't watch live this week, working on other projects. But so, like, she had her conversation with Lightning about, like, what is this Naga demon? Or, like, she's not aware of any, like, immortal Naga or whatever. And I'm guessing that stirred up something in her memory. Like, I need to look into this, or I need to figure something out. And so she went off, I guess.
Yeah, so that's the episode. Lots going on. We're now, I mean, Rin and Yukio are now going to be leading out into the next portion of this story, into the snow. I do wonder if any of their classmates will arrive eventually as well, or go with them. But yeah, I don't know. We'll see. Let's see what happens when Rin and Yukio have conversations about. I'm sure Yukio's not going to talk about what he's been doing, but hopefully he will.
Hey, bro, you good? Tell me anything.
He's already tried that. Unfortunately, that doesn't work. So yeah, I mean, a lot going on in this season so far, even though it's just two episodes in. I'm sure there's going to be cutting. I guess we're going to be cutting back probably to the school while Yukio and Rin are there, because obviously Lightning's here, so they're going to have to do stuff with him, I assume. So yeah. Any other thoughts?
I think it was, you know, kind of a solid episode just to get things, like, we obviously can see where the story is going for this season, and both in terms of, like, narrative and, like, certain characters that are getting focused. So, yeah, it seems that now we're set, that's been set up, and we got some of the, you know, the shonen romance element also. We'll see where that goes. So, yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, I think my takeaway from this episode is that a lot happened. I mean, there's a lot of, like, multiple storylines going on, which I like that. Keeps the pace going, so.
These episodes also just generally, these episodes maybe don't look fantastic, but they definitely are a bump up from, like, the final couple of the last season. Those were a little bit.
I did feel like I saw a few weird faces in this episode.
I agree. I think that it's hit and miss in this episode particularly. There are moments in this episode that I thought looked pretty good, and then there are definitely moments in this episode that I thought looked pretty bad. And it was kind of all over the place.
It's really not the main beer of end of last season.
Yeah, it gives me hope that they can, like, get better, but, like, there were a couple of shots in this episode where I thought, something looks a little off. But I think when they had the scenes and they were in the underground, I thought that all looked pretty good, so. Okay, let's talk about our comedy show on the block, Mashal. Mashal, Season 2, Episode 2, Mash Burn Dead and The Home Visit, which actually doesn't happen for the last 3 minutes of the episode, but...
I do want to say I do need to head out, but I do want to give my props. Bless Minister, the only one to convince everybody else not to do a racially motivated hate crime against Mashal. Because even Ryan tried to convince him not to kill Mashal. The big boss, whose name I'm blanking on, tried to not kill Mashal. And everyone was like, nope, we got to kill Mashal. Only Bless Minister could save the day. Bless Minister.
He is a minister. I guess he has some sway. So,
all right, I got to head out. So I'll see you guys later, all right?
All right, see ya. Okay, so let's do the rundown here. We've got Mr. Wahlberg, a.k.a. Dumbledore, is here. We learned that through some brief exposition that Wahlberg is a legend. He's a living legend, one of the most powerful wizards ever. They even talk about how when he was young, he had fought with, I think maybe Innocent Zero, somebody. And this is, like, again, so Harry Potter, because this is exactly what Dumbledore is like. So
And they said Wahlberg was a divine visionary.
Oh, that's right. Thank you for mentioning that. I forgot that. Yeah, he was also a divine visionary. He, Rain, and Blessed Minister all stand up to defend MASH. We get like a long sequence that's basically just the main bad visionary is very strict about, no, we have to kill MASH. And these three kind of go up and defend him. He's like, okay, here's what we'll do. We know that Innocent Zero's after him. We want to find out more about Innocent Zero. So let's keep MASH around. We're going to postpone his sentencing. And if we put him in the Divine Visionary tournament, that'll give them opportunity to kind of maybe suss out Innocent Zero and what they're up to.
And during the scene, like, MASH kind of like shows his resolve. He puts his fist in the air, and I think this was intentional, or maybe it was just the way that he said it, but he says something like, I will take on Innocent Euro. And I'm like, yes. Did he say Innocent Euro? I couldn't quite tell if it was like just a weird like pronunciation, or if he like actually meant to be like misspeak who he's actually trying to like face off against.
But he said, I can tell you Euro. That it was 100% intentionally a joke,
because that's in the subtitles.
It was in the subtitles. It was G-Y-R-O. He says Innocent Euro.
He's serious about this.
He pledges to beat up Innocent Euro. One other thing I thought was interesting in this scene before we move on that I hadn't noticed before is that Wahlberg, he only has one stripe.
I actually noticed that too. I wrote that down. Like a lot of the other Divine Visionaries are two stripes, and Wahlberg, I'm like, I only think he has one.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think that means that like he must be so powerful or talented that he doesn't need more than one.
Why should it just be hidden on like the back of his head or something?
Maybe. I think that'd it would be more
interesting. That'd be boring.
Right. It's more interesting that he's just that talented. You know what I mean? I like that.
I'm so good, I only need one.
So it's time for everybody to go out and have a nice day out. And everybody decides to meet up, and they all come wearing weird clothes. MASH is in his sort of black lycra skin tight exercise gear.
Dot is in full armor.
Yeah, he's in full armor for some reason.
Lance shows up and he's like, oh, look, Lance is dressed normally. And he's like, well, want my t-shirt with my sister? And here's some other merch.
He opens his t-shirt up and it has like the face of his sister, and it can move, like it winks at them.
And Finn even calls it cringe.
Yes. That's another Harry Potter thing, by the way, moving pictures. I mean, again, and somebody came up with like was somebody wearing like an animal head or something? I swore somebody else was there in a weird something.
I think it was just those three. Cause later Lemon shows up, as well as, the white haired guy who keeps saying, he has a phrase. I can't remember what his like.
I don't remember.
But he was like a very, very minor like episode villain in the first season. I guess he's still around. I forget.
Yeah, I think MASH just calls him Captain.
Yeah.
But I don't know
he was like the captain of like the Quidditch team, right?
Oh, that might be right. Okay.
Or it's not Quidditch, but it is Quidditch.
Yeah. Well, before we get to the commercial break, they decide to play this game called Tickle Koala, where you tickle these magical koalas who then sneeze out these like ice darts at a target. I will say that I don't think there's any Harry Potter reference here. This is just completely weird.
Yep. Kind of a weird scene where like MASH tickles it and then it like spears Dot in the face, and then Dot tickles it and it spears MASH in the face. Like, okay, they're just spearing each other with frozen koala snot. Sure, why not?
Yeah. When we come back from the commercial break, they decide to visit Ollivander's wand shop, which, of course, it's not Ollivander's, but you get it. The way the wands work in this world, though, is that you just walk into a shop. There's a bunch of wands all over the walls. You just sort of stick your hand out and go, wand or something, and then whatever wand likes you is summoned to you.
Yeah, they make some mention here that, like, as you progress your abilities as a wizard, like, sometimes your wand will change. And so they kind of infer, if you care about like how the world works, like you would just kind of have to upgrade your wand every so often to make sure you have like the wand that is like most current for your ability.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, and I think maybe it was Finn or somebody else was just like, yeah, maybe it's time for me to get a new one, you know, that kind of thing. And this is around the time that Lemon and Captain guys show up. My note here says that Mash is happy to have friends. So he basically, during this whole sequence, you know, everybody's sort of like, oh, it's unfortunate, Mash, that you can't get a wand or whatever. You're not magical or whatever. And,
well, he does get the wand. He picks up the heavy wand.
But before that, though, he's like, they're kind of like talking to him like, oh, we don't want you to feel left out or something like that. And then he basically just kind of in an almost uncharacteristic move for Mash is kind of really straight about like the fact that, hey, you know what? I'm here with my friends. I've never had friends. Nobody knew I existed because I had to hide who I was. And then he's like, he's just sort of like, maybe I'm jumping ahead here. I think I might be jumping ahead because I think this happens at his house.
I think so.
Okay, I'm sorry. So I missed the part that you wanted to talk about, which is important, which is that while everyone's looking at wands, Mash sees that there is a really big, thick wand stuck in the floor.
Yeah, and I don't know how serious this is or if it's just a joke. This, I guess, is the whole show. But
I think it's kind of only serious insofar as that he now has a wand.
Yeah, but the wand shop owner is kind of like, that thing's been there for a millennia. There's also like a pool of like elf water underneath it that we'll never see it because the wand is in the way, I guess. And then like Mash is just like, well, I'll pick this wand. And then like the water comes spraying up and, you know, the shop owner is like, oh, like he's really surprised. And I don't know if the elf water or whatever it was matters.
Well,
at all.
He was now, magical, yeah. Water.
Yeah.
They said that's like, oh, this will help me make new wands or something like that.
Yeah, and maybe that doesn't matter. But yeah, now Mash has a really heavy wand. Now, what can he actually do with that? Who knows? But
yeah, he makes the wand shop owner was like, you can't pick up that wand. It's way too heavy for anyone to wield. And of course, Mash just picks it up with no effort. So yeah, he's got a wand now. Big, thick, square, black wand. Or square, rectangular, whatever. It's not rounded. Anyway, the last thing we're going to do, though, is we're going to pay a home visit back to Mash's dad, and remember the police officer guy? He's there still.
Yeah.
He's just hanging
out. Out there.
I guess. I don't know if he like let them know that he was coming or if he just hangs around. I think the joke is he just hangs around there all the time now.
Yeah, he did, like, maybe that's his job, just to watch Mash's dad.
Yeah.
I don't think we're meant to think about it too seriously.
No, I don't think. I think it's a joke. Yeah, I think it's just sort of funny that he's there. But anyway, yeah, all his friends show up. They check out his place. They start acting all goofy and weird. And, you know, his dad's all super, like, emotional about the fact that he's happy that Mash has friends. This is where Mash kind of just, you know, says, you know, I'm just happy to have friends. You know, you guys are my friends now. I never had friends before. And it's kind of a nice
scene. There's another goofy part of this episode where it is a little bit Looney Tunes-ish, where there's like a cloud of, I don't know if it's smoke, but just kind of like a blob of animation that moves left and right across the screen where the friends are going like, yay, yay, yeah. Yay. Like they're just having fun, but in this really kind of like cartoonish, all they're doing is running across the screen saying, yay, yay. And then it actually shows Finn and Mash's dad kind of standing there. And it's kind of in like a really like goofy animation style where they're just like, this is what you have to deal with. And Finn's like, yep. Because Finn is kind of like the straight-laced, you know, the straight-laced one. So he doesn't.
Yeah.
All the other friends do this goofiness, but yeah. So they're just having a goofy time.
So we cut away from the house, and we see Orter Mahdi, the Desert King, the head guy I was talking about earlier who wants to kill Mash. He's having dinner with somebody, and he's saying, I want you to kill Mash Burndead. And the guy he's talking to is a man named Margaret, who has a very sort of effeminate way of talking. He has like his line on his face looks like a musical note, not a musical note, but like
a treble clef.
Yeah, thank you. And he's sort of like, oh, why would I care about this, doing this for you? It doesn't sound particularly interesting. And then that's when Order says, oh, but you see, this man has no magic. And this gets him really interested.
I actually looked up this character on the Mashal fandom wiki, I guess is what it is. This is a student. Like I didn't know how old this character was. Apparently they're 18. They're just another student. Like, oh, this character looks older than 18 to me, but I don't know.
Yeah. I would not have thought he was a student either. Okay.
But also according to the Mashal wiki, they're officially non-binary.
Okay.
So, you know, an effeminate man isn't too unusual in anime. That's kind of an archetype, no. Right? But I guess this character is not really a man. It's more just non-binary, non-gendered. Which, you know, that seems to check out based on the mannerisms and the appearance and the voice. So,
sure. Yeah, he didn't do anything like, you know, sometimes you get like overly eccentric characters. He was just sort of like, he had a sort of sing-song way of speaking, and it was just a little like eccentric to a certain degree, but not like in an offensive way.
Yeah, sometimes with these sorts of characters, they like for some reason lean into like almost like sexual insults or abuse.
Oh yeah.
We haven't gotten that. So yeah,
I think that's a unfortunate aspect of Japanese culture that sometimes leaks into anime and manga, where they're not as politically correct as Americans to a certain degree. But anyway, I'm not going to disparage that, but that's just something I've noticed. But
yeah, I guess we should probably refer to them as them instead of he, but sometimes it's hard to,
okay.
Know.
Well, they have got like two sort of like subordinates that are with them that sort of like, I don't know, they're like,
I don't know who these people are, but yeah, they're just there.
They're just sort of assistants or whatever. Anyway.
And their lines also have like, they look like a quarter note or whatever, yes. Maybe an eighth note. So they're also, they also have like music lines on their head.
Right. So Margaret or whatever goes over, he plays the piano for a moment. And he's sort of like, I don't know, it doesn't really lead to anything. He's just sort of like thinking, I guess, about what he's going to do.
Yeah, I didn't really know what the point of this.
They showed musical notes coming off the piano, but I will say that there's two ways to interpret that. One is that it's just an aesthetic thing for the anime, or it could literally be his magic doing something, and I don't know.
It seems like his magic has something to do with music. Now, I guess we'll get that probably in the next episode.
My question is, was he doing something there?
Oh, I have no idea.
Like, maybe he was using magic to find MASH or something. You know what I mean? Like, in that moment. All right.
Yep, no idea.
So, anyway, in the final scene, my notes are kind of all over the place. That's when, you know, MASH visits home, everyone's there, blah, blah, blah. In the final scene, though, we do see Rain shows up, and he stops and attacks Margaret.
Yep. So, they're like, on their way. They're, like, in the... They're on their broomsticks flying through the forest. It looks like that endless Naruto forest that they always traveling through. And then, yeah, swords start falling out of the sky, and Rain for somehow caught onto this plan. So he's going to protect MASH.
Right. So we're probably going to get a brief battle here between these two. And considering we just introduced this new character, I don't think it's going to go well for Rain, but we'll see. And that's the episode. I kind of, unfortunately, in my notes here, to try to keep things quick and not have too many notes, I skip over a lot of the comedy, but just let it be known that there's a lot of funny stuff that's happening between all these story beats.
Yeah, there was a part in the dorm room. I forget exactly what it was, but they're counting like their coins that they have.
Oh yeah,
and then MASH sees a flashback. I'm trying to remember what the flashback was about, and then like Finn actually mentions it. Like, wait, in that flashback,
yes, that's like the second or third time we've broken the fourth wall this season.
Yeah,
yeah, it's good stuff. I continue to enjoy MASHL. I think, you know, we've been told months and months ago, maybe a year ago. We were told that, unfortunately, MASH starts taking itself too seriously, but they certainly haven't gotten there yet,
No.
It's still pretty goofy, so.
It's a type of show you definitely shouldn't take it seriously, so it might, if it gets to the point where it starts taking itself too seriously, then there might be a weird disconnect, so, but we'll see.
Right, if this is the upper limit of how much it takes itself seriously, I'm fine with this, because it still continues to be MASH basically using his gimmick to make everyone look like the fool, and I'm fine with that. That's funny enough for me.
Yeah.
All right, so that's MASHL. Let's move on to the final show of the block this week, which is One Piece. episode 752, The New Warlord, the legendary Whitebeard's son appears. So last week I said, hey, Edward Veeble, they mentioned him in this episode. You don't have to think too much about him. I did forget about this scene. I'm still right. Nothing really happens, but we do see more of this guy.
Yeah. I wrote in my notes that he's kind of a wimp.
Yes, he's a weirdo. And so is his mom. But before that, Bartow's crew and the Straw Hats find the Thousand Sunny. It is basically been attached to the like rear left leg of the elephant, and it's been kind of dragged along.
Yeah, like at a normal island, you could just like drop anchor and be at the island, but you can't do that when the island is moving. So right. They have to like attach to the leg.
It's kind of neat because we, you know, that we did get a kind of neat scene where they get onto the Sunny, but then becomes really difficult to stay on because when the elephant starts moving, we get to see that and the action that it happens on the ocean. And, you know, the ships being so tiny in comparison, it's like they're getting drug along and these huge waves. And yeah, it's very turbulent. So that's going on. And then meanwhile, we cut over to the island of Baltigo. And we see none other than the head of the Revolutionary Army and Luffy's dad, Monkey D. Dragon. He's going over some reports, and in walks Koala. She's got some reports about the weapons that were being moved through Dressrosa and how the defeat of Doflamingo is going to make it easier for them to track down where these weapons are coming from and so forth and so on. We get a lot of dragon in this episode. We don't get to hear this guy talk very often, so it's kind of interesting to hear him talk.
Yeah, to be honest, I was watching this episode, and then like when you see dragon appear on screen, you're like, oh, I probably should pay attention to this, because we don't see him appear on screen very often, especially when he's talking. And yeah, he basically mentions to Koala at this point that he wants to summon the other Revolutionary Army leaders. So like, this seems to be a big, you know, discovery about the weapons.
Yeah, this is the beginning of a buildup of events that's going to continue through the series of the Revolutionary Army starting to make their moves. And the first move here is to have Koala start to assemble the other captains, the major players in the Revolutionary Army, to Baltigo. Now, I don't know. Do you remember having ever heard or seen a Baltigo before?
No, but I wrote it down.
Okay. Here. See, I have a feeling this might have been the first time it was introduced. I don't know that, but this ends up being a place where the Revolutionary Army hang out. And this might be the first time we've seen it.
Well, I think we might have seen it before in like the flashbacks with like Sabo and whatnot, but I don't think it had a name.
Okay.
So,
well, before we leave Baltigo, we see that someone else is there too. A transponder snail rings at Blackbeard's fleet, and Lafitte, or whatever his name is, picks up the phone and starts talking, and it's none other than Burgess. Jesus Burgess is on Baltigo.
You mean when Sabo like incinerated him in a flame, he didn't die?
Yep.
I remember us joking about this, because that was the last time we saw him, was Sabo basically incinerated him, and we're like, yep, he's definitely dead.
Yeah.
We'll never see him again.
A major player in one of the most important crews? Surely he's dead. No, of course not. He's not dead. We learned that he must have stowed away on a ship.
Well, here's the thing that I was actually kind of forgot about. Sabo flew away from Dressrosa on his birds or whatever.
Oh, that's right.
But I guess the rest of the Revolutionary Army that was there must have had a boat.
I mean, obviously Koala just came back. Yeah. So she must have taken a boat, right? And so I guess it's her fault, unfortunately. I like Koala, but maybe she
didn't notice. Or you can blame the fish karate guy. Those are the only three. Those are the only three we know, right? Sabo, Koala, and Fish Karate Guy, whose name I forget.
They were the only ones that were there. Yeah, that we know of. So I believe. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he's on there and he's giving a report back to the Blackbeard Pirates that he's found the headquarters of the Revolutionary Army, and that they should come and get him, or come and attack the place, perhaps.
This seems potentially significant.
Anything involving the Blackbeard Pirates is significant.
or the Revolutionary Army. I know the Revolutionary Army themselves haven't like done a whole lot in the series, but they've kind of been like secretive, and now it feels like they're going to be less secretive.
Yes, that's a good observation. So now we're going to get into the scene we kind of hinted at the beginning of it, which is the reveal of who Edward Veeville is. We see this man who has Whitebeard's mustache, but in almost every other way, it doesn't really look like him. He's a big, giant, fat guy, and he's got all these stitches all over his body.
He kind of has like I need to like look at a picture of him again, but he looks kind of like part animal, part man. Now, I don't know if he is human or not.
I think it's just that he's wearing like a big fur cloak.
Okay.
Here, I'll pull up a picture.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if yeah, I'm looking at him now.
He's got hair that's just really goes down his back.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sometimes I can't tell, like, this is just a weird looking human that that Oda does sometimes.
I think he's just a weirdo. I think that the important things to take away from this is he thinks he believes that he is the son of Whitebeard, and he is told this by his mother, whose name is Buchan, who's this little old lady. She says that she and Whitebeard were lovers, and of course this makes Weevil Whitebeard's son, and she is telling him that we need to find and kill the rest of the remaining Whitebeard pirates so that we can make money. She's all about making money. She wants to use her son to get basically Whitebeard's treasure. That's what's going on here.
She specifically brings up like Whitebeard's like the navigator, I think is who he is. I forget his name.
Marco.
I remember him. Yeah, I remember him. That's specifically who they wanted to go after.
Yeah, Marco the Phoenix. Yeah. Because he was basically the second in command,
right,
of Whitebeard's pirate crew. So yeah,
one thing I also found minorly interesting is when she gets like the newspaper and learns about Doflamingo, she actually refers to Straw Hat as Garp's grandson. I found that just kind of like minorly interesting that she refers to Straw Hat Luffy by like his relation to someone she knows maybe. So.
Yeah, I think that's a good observation. I noticed that too, and it makes perfect sense considering her age. Obviously, she would relate to people that are of her generation.
Yeah.
And Garp obviously is of like in her similar age range. I think the thing to take away from this, and I'm telling you this with very little knowledge, but the thing to take away from this that I think is interesting is why does Edward Weevil have all these like stitches all over his body? I don't think that's been explained, but I think that's important.
So I remember the mother like shows a picture of Whitebeard to Evil, and he's like, "That's Whitebeard," and kind of mentioned like he looks like him.
Well, he says, "Why are you showing me a mirror?"
Oh, right.
And then it's like, "No, that's your father."
So the implication that I'm hearing or seeing or assuming, and I know you don't know much either, because apparently this character still hasn't done a whole lot. Is it possible that she's faking his relationship and like the stitches are meant to make him look like Whitebeard when he's not? I don't know.
Yeah, it's kind of what I'm taking from it. The one thing I will tell you that I know that I'm not going to, this is not revealing, but I will say of these two characters, Buchan is actually the more interesting character here. And we do learn about stuff about her later, but they haven't done much with Weevil himself. So. But I think, yeah, I think there's something going on with these two. And then, yeah, I don't know what the deal is, but. So that's it. And I don't expect to hear from them for a while. I don't think if at all. We cut to the commercial break. And when we come back, we're at Buggy Town. And we see what's called Buggy's Delivery Service. And this is basically kind of neat. This is... what's going on here? Well, maybe you should explain it so I don't give something away. Go ahead.
So Buggy has become a warlord now, right? And he's running like his own little like mercenary delivery service. And I guess because Doflamingo was taken out, like apparently their work has like skyrocketed in terms of what they need to do. It shows like the phones, the little snail phones ringing off the hook.
Yep.
During this scene, I actually either didn't know this or forgot about it. They talk about how Hyrugin, the giant, like left their company as well as the other giants. And I was like, wait, the giants were in their company? I don't remember this.
I don't think it had been revealed until now.
So yeah, okay. So like apparently they were part of Buggy's like I guess entourage here, but then they've now, you know, sworn allegiance to Luffy's new fleet. So
right. Yeah, that's the takeaway here. The takeaway here is that Buggy has made a name for himself because he started what he's called Buggy's Delivery Services, where he basically has pirates that he works as mercenaries to go out and do whatever people want, usually bad things. Hyrugin and his crewmates were working for Buggy's Delivery Service. However, Hyrugin, obviously, his allegiance has changed, and so he and his giant friends have now left, which of course this upsets Buggy because obviously they were big money makers for him. Then the final thing that happens in this episode is we cut back to the Thousand Sunny. The Barto Club are preparing to leave, but they haven't left just yet. And they're trying to figure out what they're going to do about trying to get up to the back of the giant elephant. And this is when Kanjiro, who is the guy who kind of looks like a Kabuki warrior, he uses his ninjutsu, a.k.a. devil fruit power, to draw a giant, quote-unquote, dragon onto the deck of the ship, which comes alive.
It's a very, very fierce and majestic dragon.
Yes. Yeah, so the joke here is that this thing is super wimpy and weak, and nobody really knows it's a dragon until they're told that's what it is.
And it can't fly. Robin thinks it's cute, though.
Oh, yeah, she thinks it's very cute. And it's very, like, it just keeps moaning. It's like, meow, meow. Like, it's like, pitiful.
Yeah, this is, we know that this is this character's gimmick, like, in the last season, or the last arc, when he drew, like, their bird to fly on. It's like this little, like, poorly drawn Robin or Sparrow or whatever.
Yeah. I think there were several people in the thread that were just like, translating what the dragon was saying, and it's just saying like "kill me, kill me." But yeah, it's so unfortunate for this poor creature. Robin does think it's cute, and anyway, they all climb on its back, and rather than fly up to there, it's just going to climb up the side of the elephant. So they're going to take the slow way up. It's the only way they can go. And then this is, of course, the Barto crew. The Barto Club then says their farewell and leaves. And I think Luffy is like, thanks, Rooster, or something. Calls him a name.
No, yeah. I forget who it is, but someone, I forget if it's Zoro or Usopp or somebody like, hey, what's his name? Like Larso or Larto? It's not Rooster. They like get his name wrong.
Yeah, you're right.
But yeah, there's like Lardo. And he's like, thank you, Lardo. And then I forget what it is exactly, but Bartolomeo even acknowledges this. But he takes it with stride anyways. Like, he almost got my name right. I'm so happy.
So, yeah, this is the farewell of the Bartolomeo and his crew. So, yeah, the fanboys are leaving, finally. They are out of here. And now we're on our way up to Zo. And that's how the episode ends. So we've got to make our way up to the top of the elephant. And now the season starts proper. Because now I had forgotten about this like cutaway to Dragon and to Weevil. I forgot that stuff happened, but that's now done. And now we're going to be spending the rest of almost the remainder of the arc, I believe, now in Zo. So we're just on our way up now.
Yeah. So we One Piece has done this before with like these inter arc, I should say in between arc, kind of like cutaways where they basically show like what's going on in the world. That was kind of this episode before Zo, like, hey, here's a couple of updates on, you know, what's going on. That'll become significant later, very likely. But now that that's done, I imagine we'll figure out what Zo's all about, because I don't know what it's all about.
Yeah, that's, you're exactly right. Yeah, sometimes we get like whole episodes or a couple of episodes where we cut away to see what's going on in the world. We just get like half an episode here, which is kind of short, but we do get half an episode of that. But now we're full on getting ready to explore a new location. So look forward to that next week. All right. So that is the rundown for this week. Anything else, or do we want to talk about any kind of awards or anything?
flavor alerts.
Play flavor alert.
Potential award nominations.
The new character in Mashal is named Margaret Macaron. I don't know if that's
Margaret
written.
Macaron. Okay. Macaron. Yeah, that's weird.
I don't know if that's good enough.
I don't know. I wish I knew what it meant. It just sort of seems like an ordinary name to me. One thing that I think we may have mentioned this before, I don't know, but it is one really weird thing about the way the character designs are in Mashal is the way they draw feet in this show. You notice that?
Draw what?
Feet.
I guess I haven't really looked at the feet.
Oh my gosh. Look at any picture of any character where you can see their feet. Everybody has really tiny ankles and really big feet in this show.
Oh, yeah. Now that you mention it, I kind of recognize that. Kind of almost like Kingdom Hearts-ish.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I noticed that. I've been noticing that for a while now, particularly Mash. But when this guy showed up, I also noticed it. I'm like, yeah, like, they're giant feet on these characters. They always have like really skinny legs and they're like,
their
pants are always really too long. So they bunch up right around their ankles and they have giant feet.
Yep. Yeah, now that you mention it, yeah, I've noticed that. Like, it's definitely like a design thing, you know. Just
oh yeah, I think it's just the author's like that's his style, I think.
Yeah.
All right. Nothing's really jumping out to me as far as awards. I mean,
yeah, like none of the Bleach stuff was worthwhile. No. I don't think we had any big character moments in these episodes or any big voice performances that were worth mentioning.
Keeping our mind on Yukio and what's going on with him. Yeah. I don't know. It's not terrible or anything, but it's also just sort of, you're right. Like you said earlier, it's starting to get a little silly, a little cheesy.
Like, yeah. I mean, in trying to drown you versus jumping off a building and then immediately pulling a gun to your head. It's like, come on, dude.
So. I know. The problem, I think, the reason why it's starting to rub me the wrong way in like a way that it's like not bothering me that much, but it's just sort of like eye rolling cringe is the fact that like he's smarter than this. Like I find it hard for him to be so irrational. He doesn't strike me as that way. I feel like I guess it's possible that he's like insecure, but I don't know. It just feels like he'd be smarter than this.
I guess we're supposed to understand that like his whole like composed demeanor was almost like a kind of like a facade, like a face.
Yeah,
you know,
I guess.
You know, he was kind of like he was kind of faking it and he wasn't actually as composed as we thought he was. But yeah, like, we've kind of pretty suddenly gone from like, you know, pretty intelligent and, you know, composed and thoughtful Yukio to, you know, doubting everything about himself pretty quickly. I mean, not like immediately quickly, but
yeah,
but still.
He was always super competent, very skilled, able to sort of control situations. And now he's the complete opposite. Now he's like a nervous wreck and, you know, partially suicidal. And it's just weird. All right. Well, that'll do it for this week. Thank you very much for being here, Seda.
Yep, no problem.
And thanks again, Crocodile, for being here. No changes this weekend, just ordinary stuff. So look forward to the same lineup. And we will see you back for episode 451. And until then, later.